You boys hear the news?
No, what's up? Ain't seen a paper in a week.
Sioux on the warpath out in the Dakotas.
No.
Scalped a family named Smith.
Why? No.
Yep. Got a regiment of cavalry after them.
I don't see why folks don't settle where there's good Injuns.
Good Injuns?
That's right. There's a lot of good Injuns around the country.
Listen, friend, the only good Injuns are dead ones.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, and doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy events that we must reach and pass on the road to peace and plenty. Today, September 15th, 1946, we present the 43rd in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Subject for today,
The Vanishing American.
This is Robert St. John in New York. Here on this island called Manhattan, skyscrapers stand today where Indian wigwams once stood. The wigwams have vanished from this island. They've disappeared into the cavern of history. But today in our Midwest and Far West, Indians still live. And today the National Hour is going to retrace the trail that the Indian left behind him. We're going to see what happened to him after the white man took over this continent and what the Indian's condition is today. Later on, we shall hear from Kent Fitzgerald of the Bureau of Indian Affairs of the Department of the Interior.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington. The history of government-Indian relations is a history of two different cultures. One new and vigorous, unleashed by the Industrial Revolution, the other thousands of years old, a culture of a nomadic and agrarian people. In our time, we have seen the clash of these cultures. We have been witnesses to the mystery of the rise and fall of civilizations. From Miss Cleo Caudill, we shall hear something about that old culture as it has come down in history through the years. We are standing by.
In the beginning, when the land was all Indian land, there was only their own way of life.
Aye, the buffalo team on the plains, and the earth nourishes the tender corn. Women sow before the huts, the children laugh, and the hunters' voices are heard in council. Peace is in the hearts of the chieftains and the mild words upon their tongues. The earth feeds us, and we are strong. My people, like leaves in the forest. Aye.
Wild game thronged the forests. Maize grew, and there was plenty, as long as the land remained unchanged, so long as the land was theirs. But in the east, along the narrow strip facing the Atlantic, were crowding the land-hungry of Europe.
Good morning, Joshua.
Good morning to you, Andrew.
You're fixing your wagon, I see.
Aye.
Joshua, though Sarah is your wife, she is still my sister. You cannot do this to her. You cannot take a woman down into the wilderness of Kentucky.
She married me for better or worse, Andrew.
But not this kind of worse. There are Indians there, Creeks and Cherokees.
They will not feel the pinch if I take but 50 acres.
I do not mean that. Do you want your wife massacred?
Listen to me, Andrew. Boone has said the Kentucky land is a paradise, and there's land there for the taking. I've sweated in another's fields long enough. I'll no longer be a day laborer for another man. I'll no longer plow anyone's acres but my own.
But Indians, man, Indians! Can't you understand they'll kill you both?
A rifle can shoot farther and straighter than a bow.
In the south, the Creeks and the Cherokees were forest hunters. Miles of woodland and rivers kept their nation alive. In the west, the Chippewas and the Shawnees roamed vast tracts of land for sustenance. On the plains, The buffalo herds fed the Sioux and the Cheyenne, the Blackfeet, and the Shoshone. A whole continent was their hunting grounds, their source of supply. And into these domains, where the way of life had remained unchanged for nearly 10,000 years, came pioneer and settler, white men dreaming of land, white men who would turn the plains and the forest into farms. Into these domains came the energies unleashed by a new, incomprehensible culture, a culture that used money and guns.
I.E., a stranger is on the land. The buffalo fall at the voice of their weapons. The mother earth is torn by the plow. The axe bites like a hungry beast into the forests. I.E., how shall we live if the buffalo go? Will the hunters sit before the wigwam like women? How shall we live if the corn is taken? Will the gatherers mutter like old men in the sun? A stranger is on our land. A stranger who takes the food from our hand. I.E.
The Indian Wars in America began when the Indian tribes struck back at the invasion by the settlers. For many centuries, the Indians had flourished. When the white man first began settling their lands, there were about 1 million Indians on the American continent. When the wars would be ended, more than half the Indians would be dead.
Well, you boys hear the news?
No, what's up? Ain't seen a paper in a week.
Sioux Indians on the warpath.
No.
Out in the Dakotas.
No.
Yep, massacred a slew of white folks out that way. Scalped a settler family the name of Smith.
Are we sending troops?
Yeah, we got a regiment of cavalry after them.
I don't see why folks don't homestead where there's friendly Injuns, not hostiles.
What do you mean, friendly Injuns?
What I said, there's good Injuns in the country. A man ought to settle near there.
Listen, friend, the only good Injun's a dead one.
The only good Indian was a dead one, and the more dead ones, well, the more land available for settlement. Our government at that time, however, frowned upon such a method of expansion toward the West. After all, we governed by law, not by rifle bullet, and so, such was our sense of legal form, that we sent diplomats to the Indians on the peaceful mission of acquiring land. Only these diplomats didn't wear morning coats and striped trousers. They wore uniforms.
Chief Running Deer is outside.
Oh, send him right in.
Yes, sir.
Welcome, Running Deer. I am Colonel Gaines, and I come in peace.
I, too, have come in peace.
Running Deer, the great white father in Washington, wishes only happiness to his Shawnee children. He sees it is bad for them on this side of the great river.
My heart glad, great white father, think of children.
He is very sad, Running Deer. The corn is thin and the buffalo grow less. He will move you across the great river. There is good land there.
Move across river? But our dead lie here. We grow to men in these lands. How we go from where our dead buried?
The land is needed, Running Deer. We will make a treaty. Yes, that's what we will do. Make a treaty.
We not go. This land ours.
We will make a treaty, Running Deer. The land across the river will be yours forevermore. Otherwise, the great white father will be forced to send men and guns. And there will be blood between us. We will make a treaty. And you will cross the river.
We must nail these iron sticks to the prairie, Chief White Cap. The railroad must go through.
These prairies, our hunting grounds. You drive buffalo off.
We will move you and your people north, White Cap. We need the land, so I have come to make a treaty.
Land was always to be ours, white man said. Now he settles on our land like locusts.
Gold has been discovered here, little fox. It's time we made a treaty.
Many of my white brothers are crying for land, Chief Sitting Buffalo.
Yes, I know. The white general has come to make treaty.
Yes, our legal sense was very strong. We signed 370 treaties with the Indians in 100 years. Lots of treaties, lots of peace. But it was the white man only who got the plenty.
Aye, the forest falls, the wild game and the buffalo fall before the weapons of the strange hunters. A thumbprint on a paper makes us leave our harvest, sends us forth to wander in a land where our grain cannot grow. Aye, my people wander like the spirits of the dead. Aye.
Treaty after treaty pushed the Indians back, cornered them in the outcast places, crowded them in the lands we did not want, caged them in reservations where, like a museum piece, an ancient way of life spun out its days. On all sides, the Indians were surrounded by the culture that had defeated them. True, this was historically inevitable. The white man came with a greater and a more promising civilization. History was defeating the Indians, leaving them stranded islands in its enormous flood. These reservations were their last outposts in the world.
Aye, my people throw a small shadow in the sun. The bird song passes over us quickly. Our land has narrowed to the size of a grave. Aye.
Although the old life was rapidly withering away, there was still a good deal of it left before 1887. As far as he could, the American Indian still tried to follow the old customs. What that ancient tribal life was like is a very fascinating study, for it reveals a phase in the history of mankind. Once the ancestors of today's Indians lived this kind of life. To tell us something of the economic life of the early Indians in America, we shall call upon Miss Cleo Caudell, whose ancestors are of the Choctaw tribe. Miss Caudell speaks to us from Chicago.
This is the way the Choctaw and Chickasaw tribes got their names. Many years ago, a group of Indians decided that it was time to seek a new home. According to their custom, they agreed to ask the Great Spirit to tell them what direction to take. The old chief told his people to make preparations for a journey. At nightfall, when this was done, the people and their chief gathered around the campfire. A long pole had been planted in the middle of the camp, and the chief told them that if the Great Spirit wanted them to move, at sunrise the pole would be leaning to show them the way to go. The next morning the pole pointed straight toward the rising sun. All that day they traveled east, and at nightfall they made camp and again planted the pole in the earth. The next morning, it was again leaning toward the east. For several days they traveled, always toward the rising sun. Finally, they came to a great river where they camped, hoping that the next morning the pole would be standing straight up, but at sunrise it still pointed toward the east. The young braves cut many logs to make a raft, and the entire tribe crossed the river. For several days they moved eastward, until one morning the pole stood straight up. This was their new home, and here they settled. The chief did not live to enjoy the new homeland, for he was an old man, and soon departed to the happy hunting ground. He had two sons, whose names were Chata and Chika. They were both great leaders, and some of the people wanted Chata as their chief, and others preferred Chika. They couldn't decide between the two, so some followed Chata and became the Choctaw tribe. The others followed Chicka and became the Chickasaw tribe. Both tribes lived east of the Mississippi until many years later, when most of their people were moved west to what is now the state of Oklahoma.
Thank you, Miss Caudell.
The Indians still owned about 138 million acres within the boundaries of their ancient lands and their new reservations. These tribal lands were held in common by each inhabiting tribe, a communal ownership which had been the basis of the Indian way of life. Now, this was part of the old culture which was to be changed. In those days, some statesmen thought that the Indian could be Americanized with one legislative blow.
And so, in 1887, Congress passed the General Allotment Bill, and ownership in common of the reservation lands was broken up. Each Indian family was allotted a tract of land, usually about 100 acres. Indian farmers? Could people who, for thousands of years, hunted and migrated about, now settle down and become farmers?
Ay, ay, how can the land be marked? Does the wild duck turn from his flight at the marking? The great spirit scatters us like seeds. Ay, what can a warrior do with a fragment of land? Ay, ay, ay.
The ancient way of Indian life was no preparation for this new life of farmers, and so slowly the Indians began to starve. And there was only one solution, a disastrous one. The Indians leased or sold their lands, and in the years that followed the Allotment Act, Indian lands changed into white man lands at the rate of 2 million acres a year.
Flung suddenly adrift into a new unfamiliar economic order, the Indian was like a lamb amongst wolves.
Now here you are, leading buffalo. $1,000. It's yours. You can have it.
Why you do this?
Because you're in trouble. It's a mortgage on your land. That's all money to help you out of a hole. Why, man, it's like a gift.
What you get?
Now, don't you worry about that, man. Get yourself out of trouble first. It's only a mortgage. Like I said, almost a gift. All you have to do, leading buffalo, is make your thumbprint on this paper here. Nothing to worry about.
What did a primitive people understand of mortgages and printed papers? Well, the land kept slipping away and poverty and squalor closed down upon the Indian tribes in America. Only the rations they drew through the government's Indian Bureau kept many alive.
We were trying to make true Americans out of them. Trying to do it with one law in the books in the space of a few years. But the breaking up of the tribal-owned lands was only one phase in this attempt. We also attempted a de-Indianizing program to change the tribal way of life, to discourage their Indian ceremonies, to discourage the use of their Indian languages, the practice of old customs, dances, anything that smacked of savagery.
I must go in hidden places to speak to the Great Spirit. I must speak the tongue of my fathers in dark caves. The child is taken from us after 6 winters, and there is none to learn the dance. I am driven from the longing of my heart like a wounded bird, whose wings are heavy with death.
Customs, language, religion, all frowned upon. The land slipping away from them, their own native government, the tribal council destroyed, all in an effort to civilize the Indians, to Americanize them. And the result?
By 1920, the Indian population in continental United States had shrunk through death and poverty from a one-time peak of nearly 1 million to only 200,000 men, women, and children.
Of the 138 million acres they owned in 1887, only 52 million were left in 1934, and nearly half of this was barren desert or semi-desert.
Their economic prosperity? A report in the 1920s had this to say.
They are poor in the midst of plenty. They are discouraged and broken in spirit. They are irresponsible beggars.
In the 1920s, the American Indian was becoming the vanishing American. The end of the trail for his race was in sight. A tragedy was being played out, the curtain ready to fall. For trying to make a white man of the Indian was ending in death, misery, and squalor. A great race was rotting away on isolated reservations.
But in the 1920s, white men of conscience formed the Indian Defense Association, and this organization spearheaded the fight for Indian reform. The fight culminated in the issuance of the monumental Miriam Report in 1928, which, in quiet academic language, built up an indictment of our Indian policy that shocked the whole land, and Congress began to get busy. But it took 6 years before congressional action was taken. And then, on June 18, 1934, the Indian Reorganization Act was passed, and to borrow a phrase, it was a declaration of independence for the Indian.
First and foremost, the Indian Reorganization Act forbade the further allotment and loss of Indian lands. What was left of surplus lands could be returned to the tribe and more lands bought for them.
Aye, the Mother Earth will be joined together. The wounded land healed.
The act empowered the tribes to organize local governments with written constitutions whose rights the Department of Interior was bound to respect.
Our voices in council will be heard again. Wisdom will become law. Aye. Our people will throw a long shadow in the sun.
The act set up a revolving loan fund from which the tribes could borrow money to purchase cattle and farming equipment for the tribes.
The Mother Earth will bear her corn. The herds will wander on the hills. The river of life will run. The grass grows.
Finally, the act set up a fund to provide advanced schooling to promising young Indians, and it reformed civil service regulations so that Indians themselves could enter the government's Indian service.
I.e., the land is reborn. The grass grows. My people flourish in the sun.
There was a time when the Indian was expected to be a vanishing American, but that was before the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. Now, some statistics, please. In 1920, the total Indian population in continental United States had dropped to 200,000 men, women, and children.
By 1945, the population increased to 393,622.
Indian lands amount to more than 56 million acres. Their value?
56 million acres, value $350 million.
Schooling has been provided for Indian children in government, public, private, and in mission schools. Attendance is?
Attendance record, 67,000.
In the Indian service of the Department of Interior, there are more than 4,000 Indians employed.
The Indians once fought us. The white man was his enemy, for the white man's democracy had nothing to offer him but the expropriation of his land. During the Second World War, 22,000 Indians fought with the white man for the defense of the democratic world. They fought in the Pacific, in Italy, in Germany, and left a heroic record behind them. It's symbolic of the Indian's unity with his white brother to know that of the six Americans who raised the flag on Mount Suribachi on Iwo Jima, one was an Indian.
The Indian Reorganization Act gave the Indians a stake in America and a stake in America's democracy. It gave them what all democracies should give to their people, an opportunity to live out their lives and to realize their fullest potential. The Reorganization Act is only 12 years old, but it is correcting abuses of more than 100 years. There's still much to be done, but there is hope now in the Indian tribes. They once lived anticipating only death. Now, they anticipate a future of creative activity. What do the Indians hope for and expect of that future? Here, listen. Here is an American Indian. Let him speak for what his people desire. Kent Fitzgerald, whose forebears were the Chippewa tribe.
Out of a population numbering about 400,000, more than 25,000 American Indians joined their country's armed forces in the Second World War. Many died, many were wounded. They fought in every part of the world, and they won almost every decoration, including two awards of the Congressional Medal of Honor. Another 40,000 Indians worked in the war industries, in the aircraft plants, the shipyards, the ordnance depots, and on the railroads. Those who stayed at home raised more food than ever before, in spite of the lack of manpower and equipment. Indians bought war bonds. They subscribed to the Red Cross and the Community War Funds. Now the men and women are coming back to their homes. Many of them live on reservations, lands individually or tribally owned. Sometimes these reservations are homelands which the Indians kept for themselves when they ceded most of their territory to the white people. Sometimes they are lands to which the Indians were removed years ago. The reservations are home to the people who live on them, and Indians, like other people, love their homes. But because the Indians haven't enough land to support their increasing population, some of them will want to find employment away from the reservations. An Indian isn't obliged to stay at home. He can come or go as he pleases. He's a citizen of the United States. Like a lot of other GIs, some of the Indian veterans don't know yet just what they want to do. A good many are going back to school under the GI Bill of Rights. Many want to use the skills they acquired during the war years. One thing they do know, they want to continue working as they did during the war, on equal terms with other American citizens. They are part of the American community.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald.
Aye, tomorrow wings toward us like a bird, a great bird with glad cry. Leap upon your horses, O my people, upon the swift pony ride. Tomorrow wings toward us. Ride to it, O my people, ride. Ride to it, O my people, ride.
The American Indian has been the subject of our documentary, and this is what we've learned.
We have learned that in its relationships with the American Indian, our United States government, within the space of 100 years, signed 370 treaties. That these treaties narrowed and narrowed the land the Indians held until they were finally squeezed all into reservations. That in 1887, a general allotment bill was passed which smashed the Indian's ancient way of life, and in 40 years reduced his population drastically and left him in squalor. That in 1934, the Indian Reorganization Plan helped to rescue the Indian from extinction, gave him an opportunity to pursue his own way of life and still to be an American. That the Indian today is increasing, and that his future is rich with possibilities. The Indian is no longer in danger of being the traditional vanishing American.
On the subject of the vanishing American, then, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen in again next Sunday at this same time when our subject will be Report to Date.
This has been the National Hour. From our studios in New York, Washington, and Chicago, we have presented another in this series on national problems and current affairs. Our speakers today were Kent Fitzgerald and Miss Cleo Caudill. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.